Good morning to everybody. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you to Rabbi Winter and the Kollel, to Rabbi Shaps for arranging, to Young Yisrael Shomer Emuna for sponsoring and hosting the program. Let me throw out a question. Who can define for me what a minhag is? Who's be so brave? Not custom. Don't say custom. Yeah.
I'm going to make it up on the fly.
Okay.
Something that, as Jews, we do that's outside of halacha, but we do it as though it were halacha.
Okay. Anybody else?
I made that up.
Close?
Why did you say not to call the custom?
Why?
Why did you say not to call?
Because custom is just a translation.
Yeah, right.
I want the guts. I want what is the definition? Yeah.
Something that has been accepted by a particular group as something that can do, and it may or may not have a halakhic basis, but it's something that has always been done that people learn from their parents and every community, Ashkenaz or they go from the top, whatever, if they have any different ones, but it's something that has been tradition.
Okay, good. So now you know why I wrote the book. Minhag is very, very hard to translate. Custom, yes, certainly is the dictionary definition. Some of the definitions you heard this morning are also correct. Minhag has become part of our jargon and our vernacular, whether in halachic context, in conversation. The idea behind the book was really to explain what minhagim are, how minhagim were instituted, why they were instituted. Can minhagim be uprooted? Are minhagim things that must be followed? Are they absolute? Are they requirements? Are they voluntary? What's a communal minhag? What's a family minhag? What happens when halacha and minhag conflict? Is halacha minhag? Is minhag not a halacha? Is minhag binding? Is minhag not binding? These are all the questions that I'd like to define and answer, not all this morning in the short time that we have, but typically, when people use the word minhag, it's used in one of two contexts. Somebody will say, oh, it's only a minhag, meaning something not so important. Or someone will say, oh, it's a minhag, meaning it's something of very high caliber. Now, sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not true. The Rishonim actually say that the word minhag spelled backwards is Gehenna. Meaning, minhagim have a very, very high power potential and are very volatile. A minhag that is popular, a minhag that has basis, is very, very critical and is important. A minhag that doesn't have a basis is the opposite of a minhag, is Gehenna. I'd like to start by reading you two Mishnayos. The source of the concept of minhagim in Chazal is primarily found in one chapter, the fourth chapter, Maseches Pesachim, Perek Makom Shenagu. That's really where Chazal get to the guts. And if you really want to understand minhagim, you have to learn and study that perek very, very well. A lot of the book is based upon this chapter. Let me share with you two Mishnayos, and I believe it's from these two Mishnayos that really cull, define, and glean the nature of a minhag. The Mishnah reads as follows. Makom shenagu lahadlik es haner b'leila yom ha-kippur madlikim. Places that have the custom to light a candle on Yom Kippur Eve, that's considered to be a custom. Makom shenagu shelo lahadlik, communities that have a custom not to light a candle on the eve of Yom Kippur, ein madlikim, don't light a candle on the eve of Yom Kippur. Now, by raise of hands, and I don't even have to have a raise of hands, it's clear and it's consensus that everybody in this room lights candles on Yom Kippur. That's clear. Note, when you do that, you're not fulfilling a halacha, it's not a mitzvah, it's a minhag. Why is that a minhag? The next Mishnah reads as follows. Not talking about Ner Shama. It's talking about the Ner that we light for them. The Gemara goes into great length of detail to explain that that's a special mitzvah. It's a minhag that we do, and I will define why in a moment. The next Mishnah reads, Makom Shenagu, a place where the custom is, Lasos Melacha B'Tisha B'Avosin, places that have a custom to do work, meaning to go to work, to do business, accountant, whatever your form of labor or trade is, white collar, blue collar, places that people, individuals that go to work on Tisha B'Av, Osin, that's okay. Makom Shenagu Shelo Lasos Melacha, Ein Osin, places that people that don't have the custom to work on Tisha B'Av, that's also okay. That's considered to be a minhag. The Mishnah concludes and says, Talmidei Chachamim, scholars, B'Telem, don't do any work on Tisha B'Av. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says, "Le'olam yase adam atzmal talmid chacham." Everybody can make themselves a talmid chacham. Very easy way. You want to know how to become a talmid chacham? Don't work on Tisha B'Av. What's the common denominator between these two mishnayos? Why is it a minug to light candles or not to light candles on Yom Kippur evening? Why is it a custom? Why is it a minug to go to work or not to go to work on Tisha B'Av? The common denominator between these two mishnayos is that you know what a minug is, and here's the definition. Put your pen and paper and listen closely. A minug is something that comes to strengthen and to enforce halachic practice. That's what a minug is. A minug comes to concretize, to fortify, to strengthen, and to really put on the first base, to make sure halachic practice is kept, whether it's biblical or whether it's rabbinic, whether it's a mitzvah saseh, a positive commandment, whether it's a mitzvah losa, whether it's a negative commandment. Minhagim are here to strengthen halachic practice. Let me explain. One of the chamesha sinuim, one of the five prohibited labors or ways that we do not do things on Yom Kippur is regarding marital relations. Those are prohibited on Tisha B'Av. Chazal scratched their heads and they combed their beards and tried thinking, how are we going to make sure that that happens? Minhag. We're going to light a candle. And when you light a candle, that's going to come to help remind people and to quantify and to qualify that that's not going to happen. Thus, the minhag, whether you knew about it till now or didn't know about it till now, to light a candle on Leil Yom Kippur is for that reason, is to make sure that marital relations don't take place. Thus, a minhag is here to strengthen and to concretize halachic practice. The same thing is true, the custom regarding working or not working on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is the most ominous day on the Jewish calendar. It's the most horrible day on the Jewish calendar. It's the most saddest day on the Jewish calendar. If people are working, what does that say about Tisha B'Av? The Beis HaMikdash, Rishon and Sheni were both destroyed on that day. It's the most terrible, tragic day on the Jewish calendar. If people are going about their work in a normal way, well, Torah Matahei Aleihu, what's going to be? How could people do such a thing? How is the nation going to continue? How are we going to pine for the rebuilding of the temple? Said Chazal, let's institute a minhag, a custom to strengthen the practices of Tisha B'Av. Make sure people aren't working. Make sure people aren't going about their work in a regular way. There is not only a common denominator between these two mishnayos, but there's actually a fundamental and categorical difference between those two mishnayos. By a raise of hands, as I just said, I could guarantee that everybody in this room lights candle or a candle on the eve of Yom Kippur. If I take a show of hands, I'm certain that it's not going to be unanimous that not everybody goes to work or everybody does go to work. Some people do, some people don't. So how does minhag work? How come when it comes to lighting candles in Yom Kippur, everybody lights a candle, but when it comes to Tisha B'Av, some people do, some people don't? And the answer is not because it's easier to light a candle in Yom Kippur, so that's why everybody does it. But what does this say about minhagim? And the answer to this question is going to be very much define the difference between a minhag and halacha. Halacha and mitzvos are absolute. They must be performed or not performed. If it's a biblical mitzvah, it's a rabbinic mitzvah, it's a positive commandment, a negative commandment, mitzvah ben adam l'makom, mitzvah ben adam l'chaveru, it's an interpersonal relationship mitzvah, it's a mitzvah to man and God. Those must be kept, those must be followed, and cannot be transgressed. The concept of minhag is built upon constituency and towns and rabbinic leadership. They defined when a minhag was to be followed and when a minhag was not to be followed. Thus, the custom regarding lighting candles on Leil Yom Kippur became ubiquitous, and the entire Jewish community did it because it was such an important thing to make sure not to transgress the violation of marital relations on Yom Kippur, and therefore everybody kept it lock, stock, and barrel. The Beis Yosef, which is the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo writes, and he quotes a Yerushalmi, the Talmud Yerushalmi says, that everybody should follow this practice because we want to make sure that all the Jewish people are following this halacha. The way to follow this halacha is by practicing this minhag. Now, when it comes to working on Tisha B'Av, Chazal understood that this is not something that we could legislate across the board. It's an impossibility. You can't tell everybody not to work on Tisha B'Av. It's a regular day. It's not even Chol HaMoed. It's not Yom Tov. It's not Shabbos. Therefore, based upon communal acceptance and rabbinic leadership in different constituencies, cities, and continents, this minhag was kept or not kept. The Shulchan Aruch posits that the best thing to do is not to work until chatzos, not to work until midday. And many, many have the custom that minog, shemakom, shenagu, the custom became to try not to go to work till chatzos, because at least the eve of Tisha B'Av and the day of Tisha B'Av, people for half the day, a lion's share of the day, will be able to concentrate, ponder, contemplate, and pine for the Beis HaMikdash. I'd like to show you another way where this really, really fleshes itself out. Many of you might be familiar with the position of the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Tov Kuf Nun Aleph, is that Shabbos Chazon, the Shabbos prior to Tisha B'Av, the Ramah paskins that one should wear weekday clothing. That's the rule. That's the way the minog is written by Ramah, and Ashkenazic halacha seems to indicate that you shouldn't wear Shabbos clothing on Erev Shabbos or Tisha B'Av itself. Shabbos Chazon. The Vilna Gaon, who is a staunch supporter of Minhag Ashkenaz, himself argued and disagreed with that position of the Ramah, and the Vilna Gaon said, absolutely not, you should wear Shabbos clothing on Tisha B'Av. On Erev Shabbos, which on Shabbos Chazon, thank you. What's the tension? Why does the Ramah say you shouldn't wear Shabbos clothing, and rather you should wear weekday clothing on Shabbos Chazon, the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av? And why does the Vilna Gaon say, absolutely not, you should wear Shabbos clothing? So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky theorizes, that it's based upon the following. Throughout Eastern Europe, there were very, very extreme levels of wealth. The wealthy were very wealthy, and the poor were very poor. And Rabbi Kamenetsky suggests that the rabbinic leadership in the city of Vilna, where the Gra was the leader of the city, understood that in his town, in his constituency, making people wear weekday clothing on Shabbos is going to allow them to feel terrible about themselves. They're poor. They're not doing well. They suffer the whole week. If you tell me to wear weekday clothing on Shabbos, I'm not even going to think about the Beis HaMikdash. I'm not going to believe that the Beis HaMikdash is coming. Therefore, the Vilna Gaon's position was wear Shabbos clothing. Be excited. The Mashiach's going to come. You're going to get out of this terrible, decrepit situation. The Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt. Wear Shabbos clothing. On the other hand, the custom of the Ramah in Krakow, where he was living, Rabbi Kamenetsky suggests, is that there people were wealthy. People were successful. And if every day of the week they're wearing nice clothing, and dafka, Shabbos, Chazon, they're going to put on rags and weekday clothing, that's going to be strange. How is that going to work? We want the people to feel the pain of the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. They're successful. They're doing well. The cities are successful. People are doing well in business, right? Like Rameir Simchov Devin said, that it's like Yerushalayim here in Eastern Europe. We're doing terrific. Therefore, for those communities and those towns, therefore, they did not wear Shabbos clothing to make them feel the pain of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, when you come to a town, a city today in America, so you'll go to shul, some people will wear Shabbos clothing, some people won't wear Shabbos clothing on Shabbos Chazon. This one will say, oh, terrible, what kind of minig is that? This one looks at the other and says, oh, what kind of minig is that? You both look at each other like you're crazy. Well, one person is right and one person is wrong, right? How can we both be right? The answer is that the towns and the cities and the constituencies under their rabbinic leadership had to define customs and had to see what their community needed. Today we're in a melting pot, but appreciate where the custom came from. Therefore, when you see a gamut of minhagim today, it's not because one is right and one is wrong. One was from Hungary, one was from Poland, one was from Lithuania, one was from right Russia. And different leaderships in different cities and different towns understood that the minhag had to flesh out a particular point, had to speak to the people, and had to uphold and to take root of a particular practice. And thus, that's why we see a gamut of different minhagim. Not that one is right and one is wrong. One is correct and one is incorrect. But the point being that minhagim were stressing to uplift and to inspire and to concretize halachic practice. Minhagim can really be separated into three categories. There's communal customs, or what we call today maybe shul practices. There are familial minhagim, family practices, and then there are individual, independent minhagim. This morning I'd like to fundamentally really talk about communal practices, because a good background and understanding of minhagi tzibur, minhagim of the congregation, is very, very critical in helping define minhagim in general. The minhagim that we just spoke about, whether it's what clothing you're wearing on Shabbos Chazon, do you work, do you not work on Tisha B'Av, what is the practice regarding lighting candles on Yom Kippur, those are all communal practices. Today, Nusach HaTfilah, Nusach Ashkenaz, Nusach Sfard, Edut Mizrach, that's a tzibur practice. Liturgy, piyutim, tunes, nigunim, those are all considered to be communal practices. Pesach, kitnias, not kitnias, gebrachs, not gebrachs, giving ma'os chitim, those are all communal practices. Those are called minhagei tzibur. A separate area of minhagim, a second level of minhagim, are family practices, minhagei mishpacha. Wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed or not wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Certain families have customs that they celebrate a particular day as a Yom Tov. Maybe a family member was saved. Maybe somebody got out of jail. Maybe somebody was born. And families practice a particular custom on that particular day. You have a Suda. Some say Halal. Some recite separate Mizmorim. How long do you wait in between eating milk and eating meat? Or vice versa, waiting between meat and eating milk? Those are familial practices. Those are customs of a mishpacha. The third area is, why do I have to keep a minhag? Halacha, mitzvahs, I know I have to keep. That's the rule. The Torah dictates it. It's halacha Moshe Mitzinai, it's a mitzvah d'iraisa, it's a mitzvah d'rabbanan. However, there's another element of minhagim that requires me as an individual to follow minhagim. What's the basis of these three different forms of minhagim? Rabbein Yehuda Chassid, in his Sefer Chassidim, the Turin Shulchan Aruch, both posit that the source for communal practices, that means the Mishnayos that we spoke about, that means liturgy, nusach, are all based upon a pasuk in Mishlei, al tasig gvul shegavlu rishonim. Do not move a boundary that your grandparents or that your ancestors established. If a boundary was set, a boundary can't be moved. Just like in real estate, you can't move somebody's property without purchasing it. The same thing is true when it comes to minhagim of communities. You can't come into a city, into a town, and establish a new practice or a custom that's existed prior to that for years. Moshe Feinstein talks about a shul that has a long-standing practice of what nusach to daven. And youngsters come in, and they take over the shul, and they're now the majority. Do they have the right to change the minhag and the nusach of that shul? Rabbi Feinstein writes, absolutely not. The custom is established by the original members and by original congregation, and thus it can't be shaken, it can't be moved. Al tasig gvul shegavlu rishonim. Thus, when it comes to practices of a tzibur, of a community, the source for that being binding and not being allowed to tinker and to toy with them is that pasuk. When it comes to familial customs, minhagei mishpacha, well, why do I have to keep those? Is it really binding whatever my father and mother did? Do I have to continue the practices that they did? My dad waited 15 hours between meeting meat and milk. Do I have to do that too? My father stood for Kiddush. He sat for Kiddush. Do I have to also do that? What makes that binding, or is it binding? That the Gemara says is based upon another pasuk in Mishlei. The pasuk says, "Al titosh toras imecha, shma beni musar avicha, val titosh toras imecha." And the Gemara here in the fourth chapter, Maseches Pesachim, understands, "Al titosh toras imecha" is referring to minhagim. When it comes to practices that are familial, when it comes to something that our family does, the reason that I'm bound to it and have to keep it is because of that pasuk. Well, what makes me as an individual, as a private person, as a private citizen, why do I have to keep minhagim? The Rambam understands that the source of that is another pasuk in Sefer Dvarim, lo sasur mikol asher yagid lecha yamnu smol. I can't waver. I can't move to the right. I can't move to the left. Thus, when it comes to halacha and mitzvos, we know that the source that is the Torah, the rabbis. The same thing is true when it comes to minhagim. The source is also the rabbis. But the pasuk that the Rambam uses to understand, or as an asmachta, some sort of mnemonic device, or as a way to reckon and to reason and to understand and to define minhagim, is because of that pasuk, lo sasur mikol asher yagid lecha yamin usmol. Those are the three categories and the three areas that we have regarding mitzvos. What I'd like to do this morning, and I think it'll be beneficial, is to take a look, time-dependent, either one or two minhagim of Purim. We just entered the month of Purim. And I'd like to use that as a case study in really fleshing out what a minhag is. I'd like to use it as a way to explain what happens, how minhagim developed. I like to use it to try to define what happens when there's a conflict between minhag and halacha. I like to use it to try to understand, is it binding? Are we forced to keep minhagim? And where does this take us in the future? So if you have the sheets in front of you, it will definitely be helpful. And if you don't, that's also fine. The title is the Minhagei Purim, the customs of Purim, as case studies in understanding Purim. If you take a look on the first side, in the bolden words, Hakas Haman, banging for Haman. We all know that when you think about Purim, so there are a few things that you think about. You think about dressing up, you think about the Megillah, you think about Matanos Levion, Mishloach Manos. Those things, those elements are halacha. I have to give Mishloach Manos, I have to give Matanos Levionim, I have to have a Sudas Purim, I have to hear the Megillah. But there are other elements that sort of make the holiday and define the holiday and raise the holiday and make the holiday that much more unique. One of those is when you're at the Megillah and you hear banging for Haman. What's that all about? Where does that come from? I mean, is this just silly? Is there some basis for it? Is it some kid who thought of this, you know, in the year 1252, and ever since then, everybody started doing it? Why are we doing that? If you take a look in the first source, the Ramah, Ramosha Islas and Or HaChaim, explains where this custom came from. And the Ramah writes as follows. Od kasvu, shenagu hatinokos, the custom became for children, Latsur Tsuras Haman al Eitzim Vavanim. Kids, nursery school authors, kindergartners, elementary school students, drew the face and a picture of Haman on sticks and on stones. That's what they did. Oh, Lichtov Shem Haman alem. Or they wrote the name of Haman on sticks and stones. Ula Hakosan Zelze. And they started banging the sticks and the stones and rubbing them out. Kideshi Yimcheshmo. In order that Haman's name would become eradicated. Why? Says the Ramah. Al derech macha timcha zecher amalek. Now that pasuk we know. That's a biblical commandment in the Torah. Parshas Ki Seitze. We have to decimate, destroy, obliterate the name of Haman, the name of Amalek. Where does Haman come from? He's a descendant of Amalek. Furthermore, the pasuk tells us in Mishlei, Shem Rishoyim Yirkav. The name of the wicked should be erased, obliterated. From here, says the Ramah, Umizen nishtarvev haminik. From these two verses, from these two psukim, the custom developed, Shemakin Haman kishikarna magil b'beis haknesses. From here, the custom developed that you bang when you hear the name of Haman in the Megillah. Again, this speaks to our definition of minug. Minug is here to support, to concretize, to strengthen a halachic practice, a mitzvah, be it biblical or rabbinic. We have a biblical mitzvah. Macha timcha zech amalek. You had to destroy Amalek. Now, you're walking in the street, you're not destroying Amalek. Well, how do we do that? How am I going to fulfill that mitzvah? Maybe I can't fulfill that mitzvah. But there was an idea that there could be a custom that could support that minhag, that can help us define and fulfill and execute the mitzvah Macha Timcha Zecher Amalek. Therefore, the custom developed that Haman, who is a descendant of Amalek, well, if we bang out his name, if we erase his name, therefore we'll be able to fulfill the practice of Macha Timcha Zecher Amalek. And the Ramah continues that this is where the custom came from. I'll get back to the last line in the Ramah momentarily. What I'd like to do now is the Ramah pens this for posterity and codifies this in Shulchan Aruch. I'd like to share with you the origination of this custom. Where was the Ramah coming from? It's nice that the Ramah states that this is the reason, but the Ramah was living in the mid-1500s. It must have existed before that. If you take a look in the next three sources, these are the early Rishonim, the Sefer HaManig in source Beis, Rabbi Avram Ibn Yarchi. Source number 3 is the Avudraham, Rabbi David Avudraham, and source number 4 is the Archos Chaim of the Rosh, Rabbi Aaron HaKoin Miluniel. Each of them in their areas where they lived, whether it was France, Provence, Bavel, the Middle East, or Germany, had different approaches of how to deal with this custom, whether to follow it or whether not to follow it. Take a look in the second source, the Manhig. The Manhig is a very important Rishon, a medieval scholar. He was living in the area of France and Provence, and he pens this custom earlier, obviously, and it's the earliest source that we find, that we have a written record for this practice. He writes, there is a custom, there's a rule that one becomes inebriated on Purim in order not to know the difference between Haman and Mordechai. That's what the Gemara says. Says the Manhig, Nimtza, Pshekachai min Hagam. It seems to be that people fulfilled that practice already in the year 1200 and change. Says the Manhig, Mishum Zecher Tzadik Lebracha V'Shem Rishayim Yirkav. You know where that comes from? We want to make sure that we're able to distinguish and to categorically separate between Haman and Mordechai and to oust Haman, who is a descendant of Al-Malek, and therefore put his name to shame. Al-Kain, therefore the custom became Bifsarfasu Provencia in the cities and in the countries of France and in Provence, La-Kachas Chaluk E'Nachal, to take reeds, branches of reeds, V'lichtov Alem Haman, and to write the name Haman on reeds and on branches.
Umakishim zels, and they would rub them out. Kishakore maskirin Haman, when the reader, when the Balkria would say the name Haman, v'shem Risharim Yerkav, and therefore the name of the wicked will be obliterated. Therefore, the Manig is the earliest source to teach us that this is what was happening in France and Provence, and this is the reason for the institution of the custom, was based upon trying to find a way to fulfill the biblical commandment of Macha Timcha Ezecher Amalek. In source number 3, the Avudraham, Rabbi David Avudraham, essentially writes the same thing, and he also notes that this was also the custom in Bavel and Elam, in the areas of Mesopotamia, in the Middle East. This also seemed to have been a popular practice for the very same reason. So therefore, as we move from Eastern Europe closer to Bavel, closer to Eretz Yisrael, we see that this custom was gaining popularity, and there was no argument about it. Everybody accepted it, and this is what was happening. The Archos Chaim says the same thing in source number 4, and he also says that this is what was happening in France and Provence for the very same reason. So therefore, this custom really picked up steam. But take a look now in source number 5. This is the Maharil. The Maharil is really the backbone of Ashkenazic halachic practice. His name was Rabbi Yaakov Milon. And many of his customs and psukim that he pens in his Sefer Maharil Minhagim really are grabbed by the Raman, Minhag Ashkenaz, and those are the practices that we keep today. Look at the Maharil and read the Maharil closely. It says less than 10 words. Source number 5. V'chein hevanti, I understood, shelo haya makbid lahakos Haman kiminhag. The Maharil was not of the practice to bang Haman kinahug, as was the practice. The Maharil saw the writings of Ibn Yahya. He saw the writings of Abu Draham. He saw the writings of Adar Chaskaim, and he understood what was happening. And he understood that the common practice became to bang for Haman. The Maharil said, I'm not going to do that. Kinahuk, even though that was the practice. Why was the Maharil not doing that? Maharil lived in Germany and was a different constituency, a different city, a different country than all the other countries where this became popular. Now, what's curious about the writings of the Maharil, Maharil doesn't write why he didn't do it. He just says, I'm not doing it. And it's very hard to figure out, indeed, why he wasn't. But I believe that the reason that the Maharil was not banging Haman is because it's very nice and good to keep minhagim. But what happens when a minhag comes in the face of halacha? That's more complicated. Now, what could be the problem with this halachically? What's so bad? The answer is, and you all know it, the kids are banging Haman. It's very loud. It's very noisy. You're not going to hear the Megillah. The Megillah is a mitzvah midrabbanan. We're all required to hear the Megillah. Now, it's very good to keep a practice and to bang out the name of Haman and to support the mitzvah d'oraisa of Macha Timcha Zecher Amalek. But if you're not going to be able to fulfill what's an absolute, the mitzvah midrabbanan to hear Kriyas Megillah, so what are you doing? Mahawilu chachamim b'takanasim, one of the rabbis included or added or supported by making this minhag when I'm not fulfilling the Ikar Adin, the basic halachic practice. Therefore, you could feel the tension between the Maharil and the other Rishonim in terms of whether or not this minhag should be adopted or not. Thus, in Germany, the custom was not to bang for Haman for the practice and the reason of the Maharil. The custom in the other countries of Eastern Europe was too. We also have to understand what happened in Hungary and what happened in more Sephardic communities, because that we don't have information about at this point. But to this point, it seems to be in the early 1500s. Up until this point, it was a ubiquitous practice and everybody was doing it, minus Germany. Hungary, we'll see about in a moment. But this is the tension when it comes to minhag versus halach. And the question is, how do you handle this? Now, when the next generation of poskim looked at the literature from them a year earlier, and they saw the custom of the Archos Chaim, they saw the custom of Avudraham, they saw the custom of the manhig versus the custom of the Maharil, they had to ask themselves, well, what are we going to do? What do we tell our communities? Because new communities were being developed, and new shuls were opening. What's the right thing to do? And when you read this siman in Shulchan Aruch, the halachic authorities of the next 2 and 3 and 4 generations debated this very point. And the fundamental question is, what happens when there's a conflict between minhag and halacha? This essentially is going to become a machlokus between the Magen Avram and the Chasam Sofer as to what to do. If you take a look in source number 6, the Magen Avram writes a piece here that's very, very important for understanding minhag, and I'd like to read it together for that reason. The Magen Avraham understood that there's a problem. The Ramah says the custom is to bang for Haman. Other Rishonim say not. Says the Magen Avraham, we have a conflict. We have a battle between Minhag and Halakha. What's going to trump? What's going to win? Says the Magen Avraham, source number 6, Kasav Ramah b'tshuva simin chaf alf b'shem Maharik. Maharik was Rabbi Kolon, one of the great Rishonim, was really on the border of the Rishonim, and the Achronim lived in the 1490s or so. He says, "Dimnimtza haminag beza posik." If you find the custom in any halachic source, ein levatlo, you should not nullify it. You should not belittle it. You should not cancel it. Afilu b'shas hatchak, even in under extenuating circumstances, ein l'shanos minag, never change a minag. So the Magen Avraham, quoting the Amarik, Rabbi Kolon, an early source says, I'm familiar with other times in halacha where minhag and halacha battle each other. And the rule is that if there's any source in any halachic literature for a minhag, the minhag will trump halacha. And he goes on to continue, and he says various sources for this. And he says the following. I'm 4 lines in the Magen Avraham in source number 6. Ha-damrina minhagot ke-halacha. That which we say that a minhag, a custom, can trump halacha. That's a halachic concept. The Gemara and halachic authorities implement that concept multiple times. Hainu afilu rovdeo sfir le'asr. Even though most halachic opinions are of the position that there's a practice here that is shelo kehalacha, and there's a minhag that's telling you that I should do this, asr, and therefore it's asr to do it. Ve'hatalmud misayele, and shas, the Bavli, the Yerushalmi teaches us that you know what? This is a problematic thing to do. And nonetheless, the minhag says you should do this. Says the Maharik, as long as there's any source in some sort of halachic literature that teaches that there's a basis for this minhag, that's enough not to consider it gehenim, and therefore you should do it even though it goes against halacha. That's what the Maharik writes. And therefore, the Magen Avraham says, even though somebody might not hear the Megillah, somebody might miss a few words, that doesn't make a difference. Better to practice this custom because minhag oker halacha. That's what the Magen Avraham says. The Chassam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, who was a staunch rabbi. Anybody knows anything about rabbis? So read about the Chassam Sofer. He was tough. And the Chassam Sofer says, not so fast. Not so fast. And the Chassam Sofer is one of the great supporters of Minhagim. And if you read and you're familiar with the Tshuvas of Chassam Sofer, he regularly implements and regularly pens the importance of Minhag so much so that he writes that you could be choshesh that somebody is not part of our camp if they don't follow a particular practice in Minhagim. And his students, the Maram Sheik and others, followed that very, very closely. But the Chassam Sofer says here in source number 7, it's not true. It's not true. If a halacha goes against the minhag, you must keep the halacha, and the minhag doesn't carry any weight. And he says, take a look in the Pri Chadash, in the Minhag Isser Shelo, D'dacha ha d'marik mehalacha b'raya brura. He uproots and he questions the opinion of the Marik very, very heavily, and therefore the practice of the Chassam Sofer is that anytime minhag faces off and is in the boxing ring with halacha, the halacha is going to trump the minhag. Chassam Sofer lived in Hungary, and his practice, and the practice of the Maram Sheik, and the students of the Maram Sheik, and the region of Hungary, was not to bang for Haman based upon this position of the Chassam Sofer. So now when you go to shuls, you'll have a Jew from Hungary, a Jew from Germany, a Jew from Lithuania, a Jew from White Russia. And they look at each other like they're crazy. You're being mevatel amina. You're being mevatel halacha. And it's a melting pot jury. That's how we live here today in contemporary America. But at the end of the day, you have to understand and feel and recognize where they were coming from. The Maharil was opposed, and he said, it doesn't make a difference if we're not following the minhag. There's a halachic problem here, and we have to stick to the halacha. On the other hand, the Maharil said that this is critical not to go in this direction. Therefore, that's the basis, and that's how you see the tension between halacha and minhag, the constitution of minhagim, and how minhagim are kept and why they're kept. What do we do today? It's very interesting when you take a look at the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah commenting on this discussion very much deals with earlier sources. And take a look in source number 8 on the same side of the page. And he writes as follows. Maharil lo haya choshesh lahakos hama. The Maharil was not accustomed to bang for hama. Vehagon Yaivitz, that's Rabbi Yaakov ben Tzvi, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, the son of the Chacham Tzvi. One of the great halachic authorities of the 1700s or so was of the opinion that you should. And he banged his feet on the floor and he spit on the floor when he got to Haman. V'aprimigadim, kasab, the yatsa scharam behavsedim, shimibarbalim harvein. Primigadim says, this is absurd. You're ruining the paying attention of the rest of the congregation. So when you read the Mishnah Berurah, you're even more confused. Well, what do I do? The Maril said, you should not. Rechacham Tzvi, you should, and you should spit, and you should bang. The Prima Gadim says, you're confusing everybody. We're confused. What are you going to do? What happened here is that different halachic authorities stressed and focused on one area more than the other. Some opinions felt that the minig is more important than the halacha, and therefore you're going to bang for Haman. Others felt that the halacha is more important, and you're not going to bang for Haman. What the Mishnah Berurah does is the following, and I didn't cite it, unfortunately, but the next comment he says is, I have a way that we could try to reconcile all of this. It's interesting to note, and I didn't mention to you Sephardic practice, those of you out of there who are of Sephardic heritage, the Ben Ish Chai writes that he has a solution. You bang for the first Haman and the last Haman. Now, how that helps, I'm not sure, and I really don't know what Sephardim do in various communities today, but that's the way the Ben Ish Chai tried to get out of the problem. Now, it's really even more fascinating than that, because the Beis Yosef, which, as I mentioned, is the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, he cites the custom of the manig. Now, if you're all familiar, the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, is really what we refer to today among Sfarim as Maran. He is the halachic authority of all Sephardic Jewry. So in his first written work, he cites the custom of the Maharil that you should bang for Haman. In Shulchan Aruch, he omits it. He leaves it out. That would seem to indicate that really, Sephardic practice, backing of Rav Yosef Karo, was not to do this. So it seemed to be that Sephardim, Sephardi Tahor, those who have real Sephardic heritage, do not bang for Haman. Again, I can't tell you what they do. And it's for that reason that the Ben Ish Chai may have been troubled, Sephardim are, so bang for the first and bang for the last. But it doesn't get us out of our problem. The Mishnah Berurah says of a very simple solution. Rabbis like try to get out of problems and make things very simple. What was his solution? Bang, and let the chazan wait. What are you getting all excited about? Let everybody bang, fulfill the custom, but let everybody say, shh, and a gabbai gets a job out of this. Our shul, Mr. Moglinski, lifts up a sign, he says, stop and start. And that allows everything to work beautifully, because you keep the minug, you keep the halacha. So therefore, you see that the Mishnah Berurah is also troubled by how are we going to do this? And I think in most shuls today, contemporarily, most of us seem to follow this practice, that you want to keep the minute, because the minute brings out and it sort of gives us an appreciation for the day, and it makes it that it's not a regular Kriyas HaTorah, there's something different happening here. And Minhagim are trying to sort of strengthen a practice and make us feel that there's something different. Therefore, we want to keep the minhag. On the other hand, we can't simply do away with the halacha of not hearing the Megillah. Therefore, the common ground of what the Mishnah Berurah says to do is to do it in this fashion where we're able to do it just as well. We don't have time to really go through the whole second side of the page. What I'd like to do is make one or two points regarding another practice, and then maybe I'll take some questions. If you turn your sheet to the other side, you're familiar that another one of the classic customs of Purim is dressing up and wearing Purim costume, masquerading. There was a practice to cross-dress. And that is questionable, because as you're all familiar, the Torah rule is, Ish lo yilbash gever simlas isha, v'isha lo tilbash gever ish. So how are you going to reconcile that? How are you going to be able to make sure that minhag of masquerading is going to be kept, but on the other hand, the halacha is being shot in the leg? That's the issue. That's a difficulty. Now, the Ramah, watching this, seeing this, has to deal with this custom. So he's living in Krakow, and he's watching what is taking place. How is the Ramah going to handle that? How is the Ramah going to deal with that? Take a look what the Ramah says. Umashinagu, that which has become custom. Now, those two words are going to be critical in our discussion in a few moments. Umashinagu, that which has become the practice. Lubosh pratsufim bepurim, we wear masquerade, we dress up on Purim. Vigevre lovesh simas isha, and a man dresses up as a woman. Viisha kli gever, and a woman dresses up in man's clothing. Ein iser bedavar, there's no iser. Now, as I mentioned, if you're reading the Parsha, you're reading the Torah, this is a negative violation. It's discussed in the Gemara. Nobody discusses and nobody talks about that there's any heter for such a thing. But the Rama says, it's fine. It's mutter. There's no iser. More than that, says the Rama. It's just for merrymaking. They're not serious. They're not doing it because it's really, really, I want to dress up and I want to cross-dress. That's not the reason why it's happening. The Rama says something else, and if you aren't shocked yet, take a look at the Rama says now. V'chein b'levishas kilayim midrabban. The Rama says you could even wear kilayim midrabban on a Purim. You could wear mixed clothing, wool and linen, on Purim. Only of a rabbinic origin, not of a biblical origin. So Rama puts down two very, very shocking statements. Number one, you could cross-dress on Purim. And number two, you could wear kilayim midrabban on Purim. Why? Because it's only for the sake of fun, merrymaking. The Rama continues and he says, Mina kisvara rishona, the custom is like the first opinion, that it's absolutely fine to do it. Now, strike three is right now in the Rama. Chein b'nei adam hachotfin zeh mizeh. People had the custom to steal from each other on Purim. Pilfer. Derech simcha. It's fun when somebody goes into my wallet and takes $5. That's a lot of fun. Ein bazeh mishum lo sigzol. We just read the Aseres Hadibros 2 weeks ago. It's not a problem. Lo sigzol. V'nagu kach. That's the custom. Nagu kach. U'bilvach lo yasu davar shlo gehogin al pitovir. As long as the board approves of stealing, that's okay. Shinagu al tovi ha'ir. So Rama says it's permitted to cross-dress. It's permitted to wear kilayim midrabban. It's permitted to steal on Purim. How are you going to explain that? Now, as we discussed thus far, anytime minug goes up against halacha, anytime that tension exists, you're going to have to deal with it. You're going to have to grapple with that. Where does this come from? What's the basis from it? So the Rama is not writing his own psak halacha. He's quoting one of the earlier Rishon and Mari Mintz. Mari Mintz was a very important commentary, halacha commentary of Yaakov Mintz. And his pizit, Rav Moshe Mintz, and he paskins that this is permitted, not based upon him, but upon based an earlier rabbi who lived in about 1215, Rabbi Eliyahu Siegel, who is also of the position that it's absolutely permitted to do any of these three things because it's derech simcha. It's for the sake of merrymaking. Anytime you do something for the sake of merrymaking, it's okay. How are you going to deal with this? So I want to read two words with you, and I think this is going to shed light on minhagim in general and the idea of minog versus halacha. The first two words in the first source in the Rama says, umashenagu. How do you translate that, umashenagu?
What is custom?
That which has become the custom, right? If you take a look on the first side of the page when we discuss the minhagim, there this says, uminhag, shenagu. This is the custom. What the Rama is saying when he says umashinagu, people did it without rabbinic support. People did it without a psak halacha. People started stealing. People started cross-dressing. People started doing things that were inappropriate. Umashinagu, that which has become the custom. Now, what is the Rama going to do now in Krakow when he's watching people doing things that seem to be yisurei deraisa? Lo yilbash gever simlas isha, the Rama says. How am I going to handle that? Lo yilbash kilayim. Lo sigzo, what are you going to do? The Rama understood that minhagim are so crucial and are placed on a pedestal that he has to find a way to reconcile the practice. Because that's what people are doing. And minhag Ashkenaz, and Tosfos already does this multiple places in Shas, finds ways to explain what the people are doing. So when the Rama says this statement, he's not supporting it. He's trying to reconcile the custom against the halacha. And he's willing to go up against an Isser D'Raisa. Again, the Mari Mintz is doing it, Rabbi Eliyahu Siegel is doing it, because that's what people were doing, and we have to try to find a way to see what the community is doing and how they're doing it. Now, on the one hand, like I said, Minug spelled opposite is Gehenna, and the Rishonim say that. But here the Rama understood that there's something to it. If it's done derech simcha, it's going to be okay. Now, how do we deal with that? So Rama said in Krakow and its constituencies and the various towns and cities surrounding in that area, that's what the people were doing. I'm going to put it down. I'm going to find a way to allow them to do it. If you look in later Svarim, in the Bach, in Yardea, in his Simen Kuf Pei Beis, in the Simen about cross-dressing, Lo Yilbash Gever Simlas Isha, he is fire and brimstone against the Rama, and he has three or four very basic questions that an elementary school student will ask on the Rama. Hey, derech simcha, what kind of heter is that? Where does that come from? Where in halacha do you see that derech simcha is going to permit something on a level of deraisa? There's no such thing. The Rama has multiple questions, and therefore the Bach goes to town against the Rama, and he says it's usur, it's an absolute violation. So therefore, again, you're going to come to shul, you're going to see one person cross-dressing, one person not cross-dressing. You look at the person like he's off the wall. You look at the other person like, yeah, I'm fulfilling the custom of the Ramah. And that becomes an issue, and that becomes a challenge. In later halachic authorities, and if you see, this is really the way to define whether minhag picked up steam or didn't. The majority of halachic opinions commenting on the Ramah argue with the Ramah, including the Bach, including his son-in-law, the Taz, including the Shachan Yoredeh, the Magen Avram, all argue on the Ramah and said there's really no basis. What the Ramah was doing was trying to reconcile a custom, but that doesn't mean that it should be done lechatchila. Therefore, many Ashkenazic halachic authorities came out against the Ramah, but nonetheless, there is such a minhag. So it's for that reason you see the tension between whether or not cross-dressing kilayim midrabanan and stealing on Purim is going to be something that we let go or not. Therefore, that's how that minhag began to be developed. Note, this custom was all in Ashkenaz. Sephardic practice is absolutely positively opposed to any of these three things. Bavadya Yosef, in about two or three different tshuvas, writes that this is the most horrible practice. It's a terrible minhag. And he quotes the Rishonim that I said regarding minhag and Gehenim. Says, lo hayav lo nivra, any Sephardic who does such a thing is min aminim, he says, and they should not complete such a practice. And he notes that there were customs earlier in going to weddings and jousting and stealing and cross-dressing. And the Sephardic custom, says Bavadya Yosef, is not to do as such. And therefore he says that that's not what should be done. I hope I've given you a backdrop in appreciating customs minhagim, how they were kept and how they were not kept. Let's just read one last line together, and I'm happy to take any questions you might have. Back in the first source, the Ramah concludes his comment regarding minhagim with the following statement. Ein levatel shum minhag. No custom should ever be abolished. O lila galav, and shouldn't be poked fun at. Kilo lechinam hukvu. No custom was developed for naught. Therefore, it requires us as intelligent and thoughtful Jews to appreciate what people are doing, why they're doing it, and where it came from. Simply to abolish a practice isn't appropriate. The Kuzri writes that a convert, a potential convert who accepts mitzvos deraitzva, mitzvos derabanan, and not minhagim, is not considered a bona fide convert. Minhagim are critical. They're part of our halachic practice as a Jew. Rabbi Kiv Eger was once brought a Sefer Torah. We all know the halacha. Sefer Torah is prohibited to be written by a min, somebody who is opposed to basic Jewish practice. So they brought the Sefer Torah to Rabbi Kiv Eger, and they asked him to look at it and to decide. There was a question, maybe it was written by a min. Rabbi Kiv Eger turned through the entire scroll. He got to the end, and he said, puzzle, it's written by a min. He said, what did you see? How do you know? So Kiv Eger says, the min of Yisrael for Dorei Doros is that the last lines of the Sefer Torah filled out by different people in the community. That's what you do. You write a Sefer Torah, you give it to this notable fellow, you give it to this person to fill in a letter. Therefore, the end of the Torah scroll, the letters always look a little bit different. I don't see that here. Therefore, it must have not been written by a Jew who is accepting of Minhagim. The Torah was written by a Min. Therefore, at the end of the day, Minhagim have to be kept. Mariel, who I referred to earlier, who is the backbone of Ashkenazic practice, was the Baal Tefillah in a city in Germany called Regensburg. And in Regensburg, in the base Kvaros was buried Rabbeinu Ephraim. Rabbeinu Ephraim is one of the great Rishonim. And Rabbi Malone, the author of the Maharil, wanted to chant one of the piyutim, one of the pieces of liturgy of the Yom Noraim, because he was in the city of Regensburg where the Rabbeinu Ephraim was buried. And the people in the community and the lay leadership of the shul said, no, that's not our custom. But the Maharil said, and he writes, and this is how it's quoted in the Sefer Maharil, Mishum Klodo de Rabbeinu Ephraim, because the honor of Rabbeinu Ephraim, I'm going to add a piece of liturgy to the Yamin Maran Tefillah because of this great man who's buried here. Short time later, the Maharil's daughter died on Yom Kippur. The Maharil writes, because I didn't follow the minhag of the city of Regensburg, that's why this happened. Therefore, minhagim play a very, very, very critical role. And there are times and there are places where minhagim are jabbed at. And as I started in my introduction, it's only a minhag. Minhag has to be taken very, very seriously. And we find ourselves in times and places where people challenge, question, and counter minhagim. Toying with minhagim is toying with halacha. It's toying with isurei deraisa, as I showed you the sources for minhagim. You can't play and you can't tinker with a minhag. So much so that the Ramo is willing to forego lo sigzol, forego lo yilbash gever simlas isha, forego the isra of kilayim to hold root of a custom. Therefore, it's dependent and important for us to appreciate what minhagim are, where minhagim come from, the source of minhagim, the basis for minhagim, as a really a backbone of all Jewish practice. If there are any questions, I'm... If you embarrass yourself three times, then you're in trouble. Twice?
Back to Yom Kippur, what about the bracha?
That's a very good question. Anytime there is a minhag, and this is a whole different...
What about making a bracha on a candle?
Making a bracha on a minhag. I'll give you one...
And it's Asher Kishan.
It's a very good question. I'll give you one place where this really... is an issue, and this is a difference between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, Rosh Chodesh. On Rosh Chodesh, we don't say a full challah, we say a half a challah. So if you go to the Sephardic minyan here and you go to the Ashkenazic minyan here, you're going to see in the Sephardic minyan they don't make a bracha on challah, I think. We can ask over Rosenbaum, right? And in the Ashkenazi minyan they do. Now, it's a minhag. So in the Ashkenazi minyan they are making a bracha, in the Sephardic minyan they're not making a minhag. And they're answering your question. The question is, how do you handle a minhag? Do you make a bracha on it, or do you not make a bracha on it? This is a point of contention between Sfaradim and Ashkenazim. It's a machlokas between Tosfos and the Rambam, and it fleshes down throughout Shulchan Aruch between machlokas between the Mechaber and the Rama, whether or not you will make a bracha on minhagim. Because the Gemara signed, sealed, and delivered, and it's a Mishnah, Tanaitic literature, that you should light the candle, therefore it's almost ubiquitous that a bracha is made on the candles on Leil Yom Kippur. Maybe I'll just take another one.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
Take one more, but I have two questions. Well, first of all, thank you so much for coming and a beautiful talk.
Thank you.
But my first question is about tunes used for davening. How far do the tunes that we know that are classic go back? How far do they go back? And can you make a comment about using pop tunes for davening?
It's chapter 8 of my book.
I figured it was. My other question was, the Ethiopian Jews, really, they didn't even know, from my understanding, is that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So they really don't...
It's a good question. It's more of a historical question, but it could be that speaks to the way that Sephardim approached Tisha B'Av versus the way Ashkenazim approached Tisha B'Av, and that what they're... I spent many years living in Yerushalayim. I'd go to the Kotel on Tisha B'Av. You would see Sephardim literally bawling their eyes out as if meso muta lefanav, as if they were sitting at the casket of a parent. It's an amazing sight to see the difference, and that again speaks to what I referred to earlier, the machlokas between the Rama and the Vilna Gaon regarding wearing Shabbos clothing or weekday clothing on Shabbos Chazon. Our approach to halacha is what allowed Rabbanim to concretize minhagim. Should we or should we not? What's the area that they need chizuk in? What's an area that this town or city needs help in? And a minhag was there to bolster that.
So tunes.
I get the whole chapter. It's a whole talk.
And Ethiopians also.
Yeah, it's okay. a whole separate discussion. I'm happy to talk to you about it after. I just don't want to keep people. Yeah. So like I said, this morning I really only discussed communal minhagim because I think it's sort of a lens into minhagim in general. Familial minhagim follows communal minhagim. I gave you an example, wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So I use that as an example of a family minhag. That's really not fully true because it's a machlokas between the Mechaber and the Ramah whether or not you should wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed or not. So really it stems back to a communal custom. Waiting between milk and meat, or meat and milk, is also a familial custom. My family does this, your family does this. Well, it really depends. Are you from Germany? Are you from Poland? Are you from the East or from the West? So family minhagim very much are an outgrowth of communal minhagim. There are differences, there are similarities, there are various ways that we can analyze family and minhagim. And again, as I mentioned, it's fully, I hope, fully treated in the Sefer.
What makes stealing on Purim or wearing clothes with Kliyim or cross-dressing a communal minhag? One person does it, two people.
Okay, that's an extremely good question. Again, the answer is going to keep you here till after Chatzos. The answer is that really rabbinic leadership in a city establishes customs. Now, in this case, with cross-dressing and stealing, it was not the case. No rabbi got up and said that everybody should cross-dress and everybody should steal and everybody should wear kilayim derabanan. The people started doing that. Purim is a festive day. You see what kids do. You see what people do on Purim. It's a day to people sort of let loose. Now, that's not necessarily the right thing, or maybe it's even the wrong thing outside of a halachic context. But the Ramah tried to show that there must be a basis for this. Therefore, it's not considered to be an established custom. It's for that reason that many Rabbanim oppose cross-dressing. Now, pilfering and kilayim derabanan, I have a feeling most people never even heard of. If you don't read Shulchan Aruch, you're not even going to know that that was a custom. But cross-dressing, you do sometimes see. And depending upon the city, the shul, the town that you live in, it was either something that the rabbis, you know, looked the other way, or something that the rabbis got up and said that's not appropriate. Just like the Chassam Sofer said when it came to banging for Haman, that's wrong. It shouldn't happen. That's shalok halacha. But in order for minhag to be established, it needs rabbinic support and rabbinic institution and a constitution.
Maybe that's why in the shul that the Rav now leads, before we had a Rav, we had a Purim shul every year. The highlight was a chashva yekushi yid, straight laced, dressed up as the mitzvah lady. And you remember that?
And I abolished it.
Right? And we got away with it.
I had
a Rav to tell us what's right or wrong.
Yeah.
This is a three-part question. Can a Baal Tshuva or a Ger choose their own
minhag? It's a very good question.
And the second part is, can they cherry pick?
Can they cherry? It's a very, very good question. I researched this question a lot. There's very little written about it. And I think the reason for that is and Rabbi Yashiv writes this in a tshuva, that Gerim, Baal Tshuva, those who don't have customs, familial customs or communal customs, should pick up the custom of the shul or the town that they live in. That's the right thing to do. Just because you have a convert who's from, let's say, Spain, that doesn't mean that he or she has to keep Sephardic heritage practices. If there is a ger that comes from Russia, that doesn't mean that the ger is required or has to or even voluntarily has to keep those practices. The ger, the convert, should keep the customs of the city or shul that they are part of and the rabbi that they associate with. The relationship between the rabbi and the potential person picking up a custom is critical in light of the general city. In terms of cherry picking is always not something that is approved of, whoever you are. You always want to pick up practices and customs that are sound and that have rabbinic support and that are logical and that make sense and that speaks really to the rabbi of the shul, the city, and the community that you're part of. Yes? So a lot of it is halacha, not minhag necessarily. Meaning, in this, the examples that I gave this morning, the many examples I talk about in the book, their idea was really that the city and that the town was there to establish something because that's what the city needed. Here it happens to be that we live in a city and in a country where everybody has come together. It's a melting pot, like I said, of all of world Jewry. And thus, that's why we look at each other and say, your money, your minhag, this is absurd. So it's very hard, and you know, a classic case that every rabbi has to deal with is wearing, you know, putting tefillin on Chol HaMoed. It's very complicated because people feel very strongly about that. This is right, this is wrong, this is usur, this is mutter. It's tough. Now, does that mean I'm more religious or less religious? I don't think it means you're more religious or less religious if you wear Chol HaMoed, if you wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed, if you don't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. If you do say halal with a bracha, you don't say halal with a bracha. It depends on your place of origin. So the idea is that it shouldn't cause a splintering effect. The intention of the institution of Minhagim was to create a homogeneous society where the town and the city was doing the same thing. Never did the rabbis ever imagine there'd be something called America where everybody was sent to Galus. They never thought such a thing would happen, where in one shul you have people from Hungary, from Germany, from Eastern Europe, from Russia, from Israel, from Iraq. That never existed. Every city had its rabbi, its constituency. You had the Hungarian shtiebel, you had the German shtiebel, you had the Polish shtiebel, and they never looked at each other. Today, Baruch Hashem, hopefully we look at each other. Yes?
First of all, Rabbi, thank you.
Thank you.
Very interesting. But you must be Jewish because, in my mind at least, you raised almost as many questions as you answered.
Very good. Then I was successful. I tell the shul all the time, if I get people to ask questions, I did a good job.
I wanted to ask a question about the candles on your going to be a yard sign is going to be Kaddish the next day for Yom Kippur. And I try to remember all the people I've lost that I love so much. Are you saying that I should light another candle?
No. There are two different... One is a minug to light candles for Yom Kippur because of the reason we discussed. Then there's something else called a ner neshama for a yortzeit. They're two separate things. Two separate things.
So is one of the candles I light for Yom Kippur, is that considered one of the candles?
What the Mishnah is talking about, that we refer to as lighting the candle for the sake of Yom Kippur. The candle that you say, Baruch Atah Hashem, Yashay Kitzon Zavano, Hadlik Ner Shal Yom Tov. That candle is Shal Yom Kippur. But... Yeah. But whatever. I'm happy. Okay. Yeah.